Welcome to the Kim Munson Show. We have something very special planned for you this week. We have taken interviews that I've done with World War II veterans on my America's Veterans Story Show and reworked these so that you can hear these stories this week during Memorial Day. This is such an important week that we remember those that gave or were willing to give everything so that we can live in liberty and freedom and prosperity. I hope that you enjoy each and every one of these shows.
World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Afghanistan, and our other wars and conflicts. America's fighting men and women strapped on their boots and picked up their guns to fight tyranny and stand for liberty. We must never forget them. Welcome to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. These stories will touch your heart, inspire you, and give you courage. We stand on the shoulders of giants. Here's Kim Munson.
Welcome to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website, America's Veteran Stories. This show precipitated from a trip that I took in 2016 with a group that took four D-Day veterans to Normandy for the D-Day celebrations. And we returned back to the States realizing that each story is unique. Each story needs to be told. And I'm thrilled to have in studio with me World War II veteran, Marine, Jim Blaine. Jim, it's so great to have you here. So let's talk about your story. Where did you grow up?
Central Illinois, born and raised in Peoria.
Okay. And how did you end up in serving as a Marine in World War II?
Well, when the Pearl Harbor thing happened, we were all too young, 17. We had to get out of high school. Graduated in 42, and I turned 18. I was still 17. I didn't turn 18 until the following November. But there were three of us, and we talked and made a decision that we'd like to join the Marine Corps, but they didn't have a recruiting office in Peoria. So we had to hitchhike up to Chicago. And went in their office and visited with them. We passed all the tests, and they said, well, you're going to have to pass the physical down in your hometown. So that was the last thing we had to pass, which we did. It was about 2 weeks later. And we went through it while they were three guys in their dress blue uniforms were standing there and waiting for us to come out, so signed us up, and from that point on, we went back to Chicago about 3 weeks later, got on a train, and went to San Diego.
Jim, why did you choose the Marines?
Motto was first to fight.
Were you expecting it? Well, I guess we'll talk about that in a little bit. You're on a train, you're in San Diego. What happens in San Diego?
Well, I had a... In filling out your, you know, your background, specialties, they saw in there that I could type 60 words a minute. So they wanted to make a clerk out of me, which they did. Sent me up to Camp Elliott to run addressograph machines. No typing. I didn't know why, but anyway, I was there about 4 or 5 weeks with another Marine. And one day... a lady graduate of the one of the first or second classes out of Quantico for the Women Marines Association. She walked in, good-looking lady, but 22 years old. I couldn't ask her for a date. I'm only 19.
She was an old lady then.
Yeah. But, she said, "You Jim Blaine?" "Yes, I am." She said, "Well, I'm taking your job." So we worked together for about a week and a half, and I went from there on up to Camp Pendleton, and then I was put into the headquarters and service company of the 4th Engineer Battalion, 20th Regiment, engineers. I was the youngest one in my company, the least educated. All the other guys were college graduates, so I became their gopher for the next 3 years.
And so what happened then as So the war is going on. Do you know that you're headed to the Pacific? I mean, what's going on right now with you, Jim?
Well, we had to go through all the training.
Okay.
Qualifying with the weapons again. I didn't miss any of that, even though I worked in the office. But in January of 44, we loaded up in San Diego and went to our first battle directly from San Diego to Roy Namur Islands in the Marshall Islands, which was at that time occupied by the Japanese, and they had a cement causeway that connected those two islands, Roy and Namur, and that was a fighter airplane. And this was all part of the Admiral Nimitz and MacArthur, what they called the island hopping campaign. You could not take them all. That would be impossible. So you could jump from one to the other and neutralize the ones that you didn't take.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we did. Once we had that Roy Namur, we had fighter planes there. And the other islands that were occupied by the Japanese, and our Navy ignored them too, but they were there just in case.
So then what, you cut off, neutralized it by cutting off the supplies, or
yes.
Is that what happened?
Cutting off supplies and other troops back and forth.
Okay.
Wouldn't let them, just let them be there and starve to death.
Okay. So, of course, you're a young guy and you're just doing what you're supposed to be doing, but this island hopping campaign, do you have any idea how the commanders decided which islands that they were going to take? Did it seem like it made any sense to you?
Well, it wasn't all that complicated, but they had to know where our forces were and which island was strategic to our plan to get all the way to the mm-hmm. home islands of Japan. So we just skipped over, and you pick one that's useful to us. And that one, of course, had the fighter base, which we wanted. That only took 5 days.
Okay.
So small.
And the airfields were so important. We were wanting to get the airfields as well.
Very much so.
Okay.
We turned it over to the Air Force, and they used it as a fighter base to protect their bombers.
So during this particular battle here in the Marshall Islands, were you involved in combat at all there?
Yes.
Okay.
I was just another rifleman when I got aboard the troop ship. I didn't take my typewriter with me.
Okay. So you're what, 18 years old?
Mm-hmm.
And do you go aboard or ashore on the landing crafts, or how did
yeah,
you go ashore?
Higgins boats.
The Higgins boats?
I can't remember what wave we went on in that one.
Okay.
Third, fourth, or fifth or something. But okay. These engineers were demolition guys, and ordnance people. And
okay.
They had to get ashore as soon as they could.
Okay. So what was the next battle that you fought?
Well, from there, we went back to Maui. We didn't go back. This is our first stop in Maui, which became our base camp.
Okay.
It was already built, but that was our first trip to Maui. Beautiful place, of course. Mm-hmm. But that's where we brought in replacements for those we lost, casualties, and had to train them, of course. We had a beautiful camp set up, but it was a tent city. Thousands of tents for all the regiments and the independent, everybody in the division. One division consists of about 20,000 Marines. So Maui was a place where we did all of that work.
Okay. Then what happened after that?
Well, back to Maui, and I was another typist then, but I wasn't excused from all the training of the replacements and so on. But from there, in June of 44, we loaded up again and went to Pearl Harbor, got into a convoy, and went to Saipan in the Marianas Islands, another strategic island which had to be taken. And the reason it had to be taken was that the island of Tinian was right next door, just 3 miles tip to tip. That was really the prize of those two islands. Saipan was mostly jungle. It was about 8 times bigger than Tinian. But Tinian was flat, cane fields. And that's what we really wanted. But the Japanese army that protected those two islands was based on Saipan. So we went there with 2 more divisions, which is 60,000 troops. 27th Army Division, it's the first time we'd ever worked with an Army Division, and the 2nd Marine Division. So it took 3 divisions to take that Saipan Island. It took us 38 days.
Wow. What was the battle like, Jim? Is that something?
Well, Saipan was mostly jungle. But they had a mountain there, Mount Tapachao. And a lot of natives. The Chamorro tribe had a fairly two good cities. They had a bank there in their capital city. Garapan was their city. Had a mayor and all the people that had to run a city of that size. They also had natives over on Tinian, but the Japanese had brought in a lot of Koreans to work that cane field over there. But it was mostly jungle. And we had these 3 divisions that worked their way up the island. And the Japanese took all the natives with them, treated them horribly. And you might have seen the films of when we got to the cliffs halfway up the island, where the natives had to make a decision whether to go to the Marines, and the Japanese told them that the Marines were savages. Well, and that they would probably kill their babies and all that sort of thing. So the natives had a decision to make. And over 1,500 of them jumped off of those cliffs into the water. They threw their baby in first. They all drowned there. And we set up one of the head native guys to use a microphone system to speak to the natives in their own tongue and let them know that they should surrender to the Marines, that they weren't going to hurt them. And a good many of them did. We saved some of them with that method. But many, many of them jumped to their own death on those cliffs.
It had to be really tough.
It's on film. You can get that film.
Okay.
But we set up a nice little area for those, and the corpsmen treated them well, made them healthy again.
And how long was that battle?
36 days.
We
turned it over to the Army when we left.
Okay.
But of course, when we left, we just went 3 miles to Tinian, which was what the real prize was of those two islands, but we had to take Saipan first.
So Tinian was your next battle then?
That was the prize, and that's what we wanted.
Okay.
Because of the size of it and how flat it was. So we went over there with the 2nd Division and the 4th Division. We abandoned the 27th Army Division because they didn't know how to fight in the jungle. They didn't know how to do things as far as infantry was concerned. And our CO, General Smith, fired the general of the Army Division. His name was Smith also. And we had to put a Marine in charge to show him how to fight in a war.
It seems like there's probably a lot of emotion around what happened there.
It did, very much so. Went all the way to Washington, D.C. But anyway, Tinian was what we really needed, because that was where the bombers came in to go to the main islands in Japan.
And the goal was to continue to get these airfields so that we could get the bombers to a point where they could be in range to hit Japan then.
And there were all those bombers started coming in before we actually finished taking the island.
Really?
But they built those two big islands, and that's when we separated our Seabee battalion from our regiment. We left them there to build and maintain those two big airfields for those B-52 bombers that could go to Tokyo from Tinian, round trip, finally.
Oh, I didn't realize that the range from Tinian would do. I thought that's why we had to get Iwo Jima as well.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, let's go to break. This is Kim Munson, America's Veteran Stories. I'm honored and thrilled to have in studio with me World War II veteran Jim Blaine, Marine. We're talking about his experience in World War II. He fought in four battles, and it's absolutely fascinating. Each of these stories is unique, and it's important that we talk about them and get them on record. So this is Kim Munson with America's Veteran Stories. We'll be right back. So before we go to break, not only are you all supporting the show, but I have these great sponsors, and Hooters Restaurants is one of those. They have five locations. That's Lone Tree, Westminster, Aurora, Colorado Springs, and Loveland. And they have all kinds of specials. Right now, to go or dine in, you can buy 20 wings and get 10 for free. That's on Wednesdays. And their smoked wings are absolutely delicious. They're half the calories. They have to-go specials, kids eat free specials, happy hour specials. Go to my website, Kim Munson, MONSON.com, and click on the sponsors tab. I recommend each and every one of them. Click on the Hooters tab, and you'll get all their specials.
With the federal government printing money, it looks like inflation is on the horizon. That is why you should lock in a low rate now on your mortgage. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is here to help. Lauren works with a variety of lenders to assist you in finding the mortgage that is just right for you. Locking in a low rate now will save you thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait any longer. Call Lauren today at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881.
And welcome back to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website. That is americasveteranstories.com. And in studio with me is World War II veteran, Marine Jim Blaine. Jim, it is great to have you here. The stories are really fascinating. We're talking about Tinian, and Saipan and Tinian, you said, were just 3 miles apart. The real prize, though, you wanted Tinian because it was flat and it was a good spot to have an airfield, right?
Right.
And so tell us about the Battle of Tinian. What, you know, where were you? What happened exactly?
Well, the 4th Division, which is mine, made the landing over there on two very small beaches. The main beach on Tinian was what was called Tinian Town. But we wanted to land. If we landed at Tinian Town, we'd have to face the Japanese army again. So we did a fake landing down there with the 2nd Division. We put the troop ships down there, and the 2nd Division started climbing over the side into the Higgins boats. And all the army of the Japanese headed on down to Tinian Town to face the 2nd Division. While we were doing that, the night before, we had put Amtraks inside of the LSTs that we had right off the coast of Saipan. So that morning, after the 2nd Division got down there, it drew all the troops down to Tinian Town. So we sneaked in with Amtraks on two beaches. One was 60 yards long, the other one 160 yards long. by the time the Japanese knew what was happening, we had all three quarters of our division ashore. It was too late for them to do anything about it. So it took us about 2.5 weeks to take Tinian. As I said, it was all cane fields. But that was important to us because we knew that that would be a great place to put those big airfields to house those bombers to go to Japan.
Were there airfields there at the time, or did we have to build them?
No. We had to build them.
Totally build them.
No.
And they built them within not 2.5 weeks?
They built them once we got enough troops ashore to get the Japanese soldiers all the way to the southern end of the island. They came in with all of their bulldozers and equipment and started working on the flattening and building those airfields for those bombers. And they had already started before the island was secured.
Wow.
And they did a great job. I've been back there to see those airfields.
What was that like to go back, Jim?
Well, it was different, of course. But I had Marines with me that had also been there. But the strategy of Tinian fits into what MacArthur and Nimitz had put together. It was 1,500 miles from Tinian to Tokyo. The range of the B-52 bombers was 3,000 miles. 1,500 up, 15 back. However, our fighter planes we had on Tinian only had a 750-mile trip, 1,500-mile range, because it didn't have enough fuel to follow the airplanes all the way to the main line of Japan. Well, halfway from Tinian to Tokyo was the island of Iwo Jima.
Well, and just a quick question for all of us novices out there. I mean, the fighters needed to be nimble, and so they couldn't probably carry that much fuel, right? So, but you needed the fighter cover for those bombers.
Yes.
And so that still is a dilemma. And so Nimitz and MacArthur said, we need to take Iwo Jima then, huh?
That came into the pattern. But we bombed Tokyo and all of the big cities right out of Tinian, granted.
Did we lose bombers on that? Because I know over in Germany, without the fighters, we lost a lot of bombers.
I'm just getting to that.
Okay.
The fighters could escort him as far as Iwo Jima, and they had to turn around and come back. So the bombers went unescorted the next 750 miles to Tokyo, and then 1,500 miles back to Tinian. So the Japanese knew, and we knew, we had to take Iwo Jima. And the Japanese started planning for it long before we even started planning for it. They knew it well in advance. And going back to Tinian, it was interesting to us because they not only had the airfields there, but they had the two atom bombs that eventually, later on, of course, was dropped. But that's where they flew out of, was Tinian.
So how long was the battle at Tinian then?
Oh, it was only about 3 weeks.
Okay.
As I say, the Seabees came in and started working before we ever secured the island.
Amazing. Truly amazing. It seems like these days to try to get a sidewalk, you know, out in front of your house, it takes a lot longer than how long it took you guys to build those airfields. So what happens then after Tinian to you, Jim Blaine?
Well, once we finished it up, turned it over to the native population, and we left the Army Division there, and they took it over, and the 2nd moved out, and so did the 4th. We went back to Maui, which is our base camp, and to train and bring in replacements, again, that we had lost on Saipan and Tinian. and get ready for our next operation, which obviously was Iwo Jima.
When you say obviously, did you know that at the
no,
time?
No, we didn't know it at the time.
Okay.
The Japanese knew it.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about the Japanese. And my understanding was the Japanese admiral was actually trained in the United States. Is that
he
correct?
He was, Kurabayashi. He was an equestrian in the 1939 Olympics, 33 or 39, I can't remember which. And he was in charge of the force on Iwo Jima and had his horse there for several months while they were building the defenses there. And was he ever smart? He knew how to build defenses to defend that island, as strange as it was, because it was an extinct volcano. And the entire island was ash, volcanic ash. Not silica or sand, but black ash. And you walk in it, step in it, your foot goes down about 2 feet, and you slide back because he built three terraces there at an angle of about 40 degrees along the beaches. And the island could have been invaded from both the south side and the north side. But Kurabayashi knew which side we were going to go on in advance. Because he was militarily trained at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, years before that.
Did that, to your knowledge, did that come into account with our, MacArthur and Nimitz? Did they really think about the fact that the Japanese leader had been trained in the United States?
I'm not sure they knew it. I don't know that they even knew that he was... He was a fellow in charge. There was natives living there before they started this project. They were all sent back to Japan. There weren't more than 50 people living there. It was a barren rock, treeless. Well, they had small trees there, but very little vegetation. Couldn't hardly grow anything in that volcanic ash.
And how? What's the distance from Iwo Jima then to Tokyo?
1,500 miles.
Total.
Oh, excuse me, 750 miles.
So our fighters then could accompany the bombers. So as you're preparing for this particular battle, you're back on Maui. Is there anything special that you guys are doing regarding preparation?
No, just the same as far as I was concerned. I was just a kind of a gopher. I didn't have all the intelligence that was going on because I helped train the replacements and did all my office work. I did work with the corpsmen, made a lot of friends because they always had to have a gopher to keep them resupplied and hold the blood the vessels while they were needing and put your hands on the wound sometimes and haul bodies back and forth, both dead ones and casualties. So not that I enjoyed the job, but that's what I did instead of using my typewriter on the battlefield.
Helping the wounded and the dead, I mean, it's part
the
of
burial
war.
Detail.
Yeah. It's tough, isn't it?
Of course.
Yeah.
But
it had to be done.
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so as we are looking towards Iwo Jima, when did you start to prepare for that? When did you guys start to get the orders that things were going to be happening?
Well, my squad leader kept us informed as to what we were going to be doing. In fact, we didn't learn... The guy, just general troops, we didn't learn what island we're going to until we left Honolulu to go there.
And that's because of security, right?
Security.
Mm-hmm. What about, let's just ask about this. How about letters home? Did your family know where you were? Did you get letters from home often? Or
sure. We got mail was a good delivery, particularly at Maui. And we could not tell them where we were based, nor could we tell them where we were going or where we had been.
Ah.
We had a censor right in our office. We had several of them in our base camp. But all of our correspondence like that was censored.
But letters home and receiving letters and sending letters was a really important component of life, wasn't it?
Definitely. Yeah. Sending pictures back and forth. We couldn't take a camera with us to the battlefield. We couldn't take a notebook or a paper or pencils. Not allowed to do that.
Well, was it loose lips, sink ships, and you know, all that kind of...
I suppose.
Kind of that stuff. So you're preparing to go to Iwo Jima. And so what time of year is this now, Jim Bling?
Well, let's see. January of 45.
And just a question. So in June of 44, you were engaging in battle in the Pacific. Were you getting much news from what was happening in Europe with D-Day and all of that?
Some, yes.
Was that heartening to know that the Allies had actually gotten on to the main continent over there? Was that good for morale?
Very much so. We got that information when we were aboard a troop ship. And very happy with it. Because we realized that those troops would probably be eventually coming over to the Pacific to help us.
Mm-hmm.
With what we were doing. And that was the plan. As you probably know, those guys at Europe were allowed to go home, but nevertheless, they were planning to go to Japan, unfortunately.
And my understanding, many of them, after the surrender of Hitler in Europe, they, in fact, did think that they were headed to the Pacific. So, Jim, we're just about done with this second segment. We have one more, so I think let's go to break. This is Kim Munson with America's Veterans Stories. Be sure and check out the website, americasveteransstories.com. A World War II veteran, Marine Jim Blaine, is in studio. It's a great honor to get to have this interview, so let's go to break and we'll be right back.
Hey, before we go to break, I am thrilled to be talking with one of my valued sponsors, and that is Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial. Lauren, it's so great to talk with you.
Oh, you as well. Thank you, Kim.
You know, you're a valued partner, and this is a really special show, but why have you decided to be my partner on this?
These veterans have earned the right to have our respect, and I recognize that, and they also need to know about certain benefits that are available to them based on their service, and I have some benefits that I can offer, I feel.
Okay, and you're a real specialist in helping people in finding just the right individual mortgage for them. And as you mentioned, there's some very special things as we were preparing for this. You said, this is something that we probably have gotten right, and I love that. So explain.
Exactly. I think a lot of people, when they hear that the government is getting involved with something, think it's going to be a huge mess and maybe go sideways. But I really think when it comes to home lending, the VA loan is something that the government did well. It really affords these veterans some benefits that are not available to the regular home buyer or homeowner. And if they don't know about it or aren't aware of it, they need to learn about it.
So what would some of those benefits be, Lauren Levy?
Okay, so with eligibility, a veteran is entitled to, let's say, purchase a home with 0% down. With no mortgage insurance added on. Someone looking to refinance, if they just wanted to take advantage of a lower rate, there's a VA IRL program, which is like a streamlined, low document refinance, doesn't require an appraisal or income proof.
People could lock in a much lower rate.
Absolutely.
Maybe. Okay.
And they could, if they wanted to pay off some debt, some bills, they can take cash out of their home all the way up to 100% of the value. These are all things that aren't available to a normal non-veteran homebuyer or homeowner.
It seems like it's a great way for we as Americans to say thank you to these men and women who have stepped up and have been willing to put it all on the line to protect us and protect our freedoms. And so, yeah, I'm glad to hear that it looks like that probably we got this right.
Exactly. I think, you know, when these guys come home from wherever they're coming back from, it's hard to, you know, step right back into society and have a big down payment saved up like most people that work a 9-to-5 job do. So these guys are entitled to come back and have zero down and still own a home because while they're off doing their thing, they oftentimes have wives and kids or husbands and kids here that need a roof to over their head and need to be able to pay that mortgage and without a huge down payment.
Okay, so if people want more information, Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial, what's the best way for people to reach out to you?
So the best way is to just call us at 303-880-8881. You can always go to our website at www.polyfigroup.com. There's information there, but to call is the easiest way. You're going to get me most of the time, and I'm glad to talk this over, and I know all the information, and all we need to know is if someone's eligible for it through their military service, and it really is a great program for these guys and gals.
Okay, so Lauren Levy, again, your number is 303-880-8881. So again, 303-880-8881.
That's correct.
And thank you so much for being a partner.
Absolutely, thank you.
Well, this is Kim Munson. We're going to go to break. We'll be right back.
Home ownership and private property rights help you build wealth for you and your family. RE/MAX Alliance award-winning realtor Karen Levine understands this. Supply is super tight right now. This is why you need a seasoned professional with excellent negotiating skills on your side of the table, whether buying or selling an existing home or buying a new build. As a member of the National Association of Realtors Board of Directors, Karen Levine volunteers hours of her time to help you build your American dream. Call her today at 303-877-7516. Again, that's 303-877-7516.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Would you have ever dreamed that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion would be under assault and attack in America? Unbelievably, it is happening right before our eyes. That is why it is important to keep free-thinking, independent voices on the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Kim Munson is one of those important voices. Help her keep independence alive. Go to KimMunson.com to contribute to join Kim in the battle of ideas raging in America today. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Americans Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Sunday afternoons at 3 here on KLZ 560 AM and KLZ 100.7.
From the mountains to the prairies to the ocean.
On the line with me is Hal Van Herke. He is an entrepreneur. He and his wife, Linnea, own Castlegate Knife and Tool, which is located right here in Sedalia, Colorado. And Hal is a sponsor of both of our shows, The Kim Munson Show and America's Veteran Stories. And I so appreciate that. Hal, I know that you have really enjoyed these shows that we've done this week with these World War II veterans. And, of course, the interview we're doing today with Don Whipple at the Battle of Iwo Jima. And you're a veteran, Hal Van Herke. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ken. I appreciate it. And I do enjoy this program. I'm old enough that my father served in World War II. My uncles all served in World War II. And so they served all over the globe. So a lot of these stories are really close to home.
Well, and you are a veteran, and Castlegate Knife and Tool, you actually offer a discount all day, every day for our veterans and military and first responders. And I know that that's just really important to you, Hal.
Yeah, we believe that our veterans, our first responders, are a unique and special type of person that have protected this country and served this country, in some cases, for generations. And we want to thank them for that contribution and that sacrifice. So we give a 10% discount all day, every day to any veteran any active duty service member or active duty or active first responder. If you come into the store in Sedalia, show us your ID and you'll get a 10% discount off of anything in the store. If you want to take advantage of that on the website, just contact us via email or phone or through social media, and we'll give you a one-time use code that you can purchase anything on the website and get 10% off. It's just our way of recognizing not only your contribution, but the fact that our warriors are a key part of our society and make society work. And we value them, not only their contribution, but the type of people they are and who they are as a person.
Well, thank you, Hal Van Herky. And that website is castlegate.com, castlegate.com. Hal Van Herky, thank you for your sponsorship, and we will talk to you next week. Jim Blaine, World War II veteran, fought in four different battles in the Pacific Theater, and we're talking about one of the most important battles. They are all important, but this was really an important one, and that was the battle for Iwo Jima. Jim Blaine, you said it really wasn't much of an island to look at. It was a volcano, but it was really, really important. So set that up for our listeners.
Yeah, Iwo was strategically located where it should be. It was 750 miles from Tokyo, so to speak. And that's as far as our fighter planes could go. And, of course, Kobayashi, the general who took over Iwo for Japan, built 16 miles of caves and tunnels in that island from one end to the other. And that's where many of the Japanese troops were hiding out, even though we had a front line. But it was brutal. Not only the landing itself, because we got bogged down in that volcanic ash. You couldn't dig a foxhole. You couldn't walk in it. All you could do is hide in a bomb crater. And we lost, I don't know, I think we had 2,000 killed the first 2 days. And my CO was one of the beachmasters, and his contact ashore had become a casualty. So he went to plan B, which is to go ashore after dark and take a bodyguard. Well, being the gopher of the company, they took me. All I had was an M1. And but at midnight, he commandeered a Higgins boat from one of the Navy ships, and he and I creeped in with the guy that was driving the Higgins boat.
So there was only you and him?
Yeah.
And the driver on the Higgins boat?
All right. Just the two.
Honestly?
Three of us.
Oh, my God.
I thought the poor guy driving the boat was going to collapse. But anyway, we got ashore, and he went off to find whatever contact he was supposed to find, and he told me to find a place to sleep. So I climbed down in a hole that one of the radio men had dug for his generator and finished the rest of the night.
Do you really sleep?
I don't think so. I'm surprised I didn't collapse with the gas coming off of that generator, but at least it was a place to hide because they were still firing.
Okay.
In the middle of the night. But the next morning, I had to find an officer and told him who I was and what I was there for, and he put me to work. My first job was getting bodies and body parts out of the surf so that more ships could come in.
Wow.
And more equipment. So I was just put anywhere they needed me, which was fine, but we were still under fire, particularly the second day and third day.
Well, and my understanding is that we had been using air power to try to soften up the island, and our leaders thought that we had softened it up, but we hadn't. And so the battle, we thought, would be just a few days, and it was much, much longer.
Much longer. Yes. James Forrestal, Secretary of the Army, was there, or the military was there, on one of the capital ships. And he and his committee, whoever it was, told all of us, that all the leaders, that this, when they look at the island, it's so small. And we think about Roy Namur. We took that in 5 or 6 days. And they said, oh, well, we won't have any trouble here. And the plan for our division was to go at Iwo for 5 or 6 days and turn it over to the Army and then go to Okinawa. Well, thank the Lord for our general, our 4th Division General, Holland M. Smith. He was in charge, Lieutenant General. And he made sure that we had a 3rd Division of Marines in reserve. And it was the 3rd Marine Division. I don't know if we hadn't had that, we would have been able to win that battle. Because they went ashore the 4th day. In other words, you had 20,000 Marines in each division.
Uh-huh.
That's 60,000 Marines. But a reinforced division is 22,000. So that's 66,000 Marines we had on that island. 8 square miles.
I think I read something, Jim Blaine, that said that Iwo Jima, at that particular battle, had more humanity per square foot than Manhattan did in New York.
That was probably true at times.
So, yeah, that was really key. I think I remember you telling me that was really important that there was that other division because we didn't realize how tough the battle was going to be. Why do you think that he did that? I mean, was it luck strategically? Was he smart? I mean,
He was smart.
Okay.
And he was forceful
mm-hmm. That
way. As I told you, he fired that lieutenant general down in Saipan because he wasn't following orders.
That had to be something. I just can't even imagine what those conversations would be like. But, you know, a good leader does realize that you have to surround yourself with good people.
Well, he was in charge.
Yeah. Okay.
In spite of the other generals they had.
Okay. Jim Blaine, tell me about the guys coming over the side, getting into the landing craft. That had to be something to watch, to see the...
I mean, coming over the
side of the boat, and getting into the landing craft, getting into the Higgins boats, going into shore. That had to be something to see.
Well, they used these great big rope nets
mm-hmm.
that had little squares in them, roll them over the side of the troop ship. And... The first three guys down the net, their job was to get down into the Higgins boat and then hold the net out away from the troop ship because the Higgins boat was bouncing like a cork. Now, the troop ship wasn't moving, but any kind of a swell, those Higgins boats were just going up and down.
Uh-huh.
And we learned when we were training, if you don't hold those ropes away from the ship and the guy's feet are through there, had some broken feet.
Okay.
When that Higgins boat came down on their toes.
Okay.
So naturally, one of the guys was me that had to do that.
You were one of the first guys down to have to hold?
Of course.
Oh, my gosh, Jim.
I lost my grip and fell in Saipan into the Higgins boat and got hurt badly.
Oh, my gosh. And how far would you be climbing down off the boat?
It was about a good 25 or 30 feet.
Gee-man-y.
And I think the last 10 feet, remember the Higgins boats were going up and down.
Uh-huh.
So you might be 8 feet from it for a while. Then from there, the next minute, you're 18 feet from
uh-huh.
it.
Oh.
So I lost my grip and fell into the Higgins boat.
Oh,
there was nobody else there to stop me. But and I got hurt, my hip and my shoulder and my knee. And that's why I'm walking with a cane today.
So how old are you, Jim Blaine?
95.
I think it's okay that you're walking with the cane, but okay. So, so we've talked a bit about the battle. The battle went on for what, 30 some days or 30, 40 days?
36 days.
36 days. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about raising the flag on Mount Suribachi. Where were you when that occurred?
We were moving up the island, and our back was to Suribachi, but the rumor was going, around at the time, that the top of Mount Suribachi was going to be secured because we were being fired at from behind and in front of us. One of our squads were moving around. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very practical. But when it happened, that little tiny flag they put up there, we didn't see it because we were busy what we had ahead of us. Mm-hmm. But all the ships in the harbor and everybody that had a horn or a gun, they had a huge transport ship and Navy ships out there, all started to put up this noise. Sirens blowing, and we didn't even have to turn around. We knew what had happened.
It had to be great for morale.
One guy broke out in tears.
Wow.
My squad.
Wow. So there were two flag raisings really there, though, at Mount Suribachi. There was the smaller one. Then my understanding is, let's get a bigger flag. And so they raised that again. And that is now what is depicted on the sculpture for the Marine Memorial, which it just takes my breath away.
Yeah. Yeah, they had they wanted to take that little flag down, Forrestal. And he said, you better get that one down and put a second one up there because that first leg, somebody will steal it. And he was right. Okay. So they sent a flag that was taken off an LST here and donated and hauled it up there. And while they took the first flag down, the second one went up. Now, this gets complicated because later on, even years later on, this year, they made a decision that some of those guys were misidentified. They raised that flag, the second one, the famous one.
Uh-huh.
Complicated.
I could see how that could happen. So, well, Jim Blaine, we're getting close to the end of the show. This has gone really, really quickly. But anything else about Iwo Jima that you think our listeners should know?
Well, I was wounded on the March the 4th. At night, I was in guard duty, and eventually I went out to a troop ship to be taken to a hospital in Saipan. And while we were waiting there to get underway, seven of the guys died on the ship. They had to take them ashore and replace them in the cots. We didn't want to go empty. And as we were getting ready to leave, somebody looked off in the distance, and he thought he saw a bomber. And as it got forward closer and closer, sure enough, it was. That was the first bomber to land on that strip. Well, you mentioned they had no fuel. They had no armament. They'd gotten rid of it. They had no bombs. They'd gotten rid of those. So the short airfield, they felt that they could land on it, and they did. They took this plane down and landed the B-52. Barely. Well, the ship was called Dynamite, but there was two words, Dynamite. But then again, she might not.
Oh, was that not a thrill to see that land, though?
Yes.
After that battle, that to know what you'd accomplished?
First bomber to land.
Oh, wow.
So we saved over 60,000 airmen were saved. 16,000, excuse me. Airmen were saved because that was a sanctuary for a crippled bomber.
Wow.
Over 2,000 aircraft used Iwo as a sanctuary. Otherwise, they'd had to go in the ocean, which many of them did before we took the island.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, Jim Blaine, we've got just a couple of minutes left. We were talking about Tinian during the break, and Tinian was the place that the bombers took off from that bombed Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And you've been back, so tell us what it looks like now.
Well, we've been back to Iwo, and we also went to Nagasaki on the same trip. Just a barren rock. The sand, the ash is still there.
Okay.
It's part of the Japanese Empire.
Right.
And
we're talking about Iwo now.
Iwo. Mm-hmm. The fact that we took Iwo, which was part of the Japanese Empire, the attitude of the troops, the Japanese troops, changed dramatically. They were willing, more than willing, than they even were before, to sacrifice their own life. And they would come out of those caves and tunnels and run at us with a hand grenade in each hand, one for themselves and one for us.
Wow.
And we lost,
you lost
some of our guys,
some of our guys that way.
Okay. But we had enough flamethrowers and BARs that we could squash them. But I didn't get into the last part of the battle because I left and went to Saipan on that.
Okay. Because you were wounded.
I was wounded. I went on a troop shift.
Okay.
With 600 other casualties.
Okay.
On that one ship.
Well, Jim Blaine, we are just about out of time. I just, first of all, want to say thank you. What would be the final thought that you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
Thank heaven for the fact that we had the atom bomb. And it saved many, many thousands of lives, not only Japanese, but American lives that would have been sacrificed had we had to go in there and try to take those islands from the Japanese people. To die for the emperor was a thrill for your family. Mm-hmm. To surrender was a box on your family. Well, one thing I think I should mention to you, and I wanted to mention, is the fact that 27 medals of honor were issued in that single battle, which is a world record for an 8-square-mile island. One of those gentlemen is still living. The rest are deceased.
Okay. Wow, that is amazing. So, yes, I've heard that from every veteran, that this saved many, many American lives and many, many Japanese lives. Jim Blaine, it is an honor. I truly admire you. I thank you. When I say we stand on the shoulders of giants as Americans, we stand on the shoulders of those like you. And I so appreciate it. So thank you so much. And my friends, this is Kim Munson with America's Veteran Stories signing off. God bless you and God bless America.